From Public Radio International, I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Think of the Great Barrier Reef off northeastern Australia as the underwater version of the Brazilian rainforest. It's actually a network of several thousand coral reefs in clear, shallow tropical waters. Like the rainforest, it's the breeding ground, the haven and habitat of millions of species that might not sustain themselves anywhere else. And like the rainforest, the reef chain has been in effect bombarded by carbon ever since human industry came to depend on burning coal and oil. And it's suffering the further effects of the greenhouse gases and the warming trend that are churning up the chemistry, the populations, the productivity of all the plants and animals in the ocean food chain, which is part of our food chain too. Here's the scientist's frame on the matter. On current trends, the Great Barrier Reef will lose 95% of its living coral by the year 2050. Then what? The warming of all the oceans is next on Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, a radio conversation with internet range, fast, free, and global at radioopensource.org. Climate change has the same scope with a vengeance. Global warming is not just about the atmosphere, and it doesn't stop at the water's edge either. Under the two-thirds of the Earth's surface that is oceans, marine biologists have ways of measuring another whole system of effects that slow changes in temperature bring to the critical fish food plankton, to the acidity of the salt water, even to the layers of ocean life and the currents large and small that stir it up. We're thinking of global warming this hour as if it was oceans only. Meet us underwater with mask and snorkel on the website at www.radioopensource.org. We begin with Scott Doney, senior scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. You're our Jacques Cousteau, Scott Doney, this hour. Take us into the ocean, if you will, and show us how to see what's happening.
Well, thanks, Chris. I guess when you call it global warming, one way to think about it is it's actually primarily ocean warming. The heat that we've been building up because of the buildup of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, most of that has actually ended up in the ocean. And we have a pretty good sense of that based on observations.
More than in the atmosphere, more than in the desert, more than in the Gulf of Mexico?
Well,
or is it the Gulf of Mexico we're talking about?
Yeah, I count the Gulf of Mexico as part of the ocean.
Of course.
Well, if you think about it, think about how much heat it takes to heat, say, the water for your bathtub or for your shower. Well, the ocean can also act as a huge reservoir for heat. And so although the atmosphere has been warming up, the ocean has been warming up. You know, the heat content is about, 30 or 40 times greater because it has a huge capacity to store heat. And so one of the things when we look at the data that's been collected over the last 50 years is we see that the upper ocean has been getting warmer. There's less sea ice in the poles, particularly in the Arctic. There's concern about changes in ocean circulation. And there's also concerns about sea level, because it turns out when you heat seawater, it actually expands slightly. And we're starting to see rising sea levels around the globe. And when you compound that with the fact that we're melting glaciers and the glacial ice sheets, we expect coastal communities to see a lot of problems into the future associated with sea level.
So it's not just Greenland melting. It's the water expanding that's going to change the sea level.
Right.
That part we're halfway familiar with. We're less familiar with ocean circulation and, you know, the stratification that you speak of in the upper ocean. Let's get into it. What do you mean by ocean circulation?
Well, there's a couple of things that move the water around. One is when the wind blows on the ocean, on the surface of the ocean, it actually sets up currents. So, for example, the Gulf Stream that's offshore here in off of Cape Cod, or the Kuroshio, which is a large current off of Japan. But there's also a part of the ocean circulation that's driven by the fact that waters are very cold and dense at high latitudes, and they actually sink down to the bottom of the ocean. And so the deep part of the ocean is actually filled with water that was formed either in the North Atlantic off of Greenland and Iceland or down off of Antarctica. And one of the concerns is that what we call the thermohaline circulation or the overturning circulation might be changed because we're warming the surface of the planet.
Thermohaline meaning some combination of salt and heat.
Yeah, exactly. It's a fancy word for salt and heat-driven circulation.
And what are some of the effects of changes in those currents?
Well, those currents do a couple of things. One is that the ocean is actually, you know, when we burn fossil fuels, when we get in our car and we turn it on and we burn gasoline, or when flip an electrical switch in a coal-burning power plant burns a little more coal, not all the carbon dioxide that we release stays in the atmosphere. So about a third of it actually goes into the ocean. And part of the way it goes into the ocean is it gets sucked up in this polar circulation where you have this deep water sinking at high latitudes. So we're actually going to be making the problem of the buildup of CO2 and global warming worse if the circulation of the ocean starts to slow down. We basically don't get the ocean acting as a trap for all those pollutants because it's just not mixing and moving around as fast.
Let's talk about the carbonization of the oceans. Billions of tons now of carbon have been deposited in the ocean. So what? Could you show us the effect if we were swimming around in it? I mean, what does it mean to carbonate the water? We're not talking about fizzy bubbles, but what are we talking about?
No, we're not talking about fizzy bubbles. But it, in many ways, it's similar to what happens when you form a can of soda, which is the carbon dioxide is a gas. It dissolves in water like any other gas. But one of the things that's different is it actually chemically combines with water to form a weak acid. It forms something called carbonic acid. And that carbonic acid is actually changing the pH or the acidity of the ocean as we're building up these, as you say, billions and billions of tons. And the problem isn't so much for, say, someone bathing in the ocean as it is for a lot of the organisms that live in the ocean, particularly those that build shells out of calcium carbonate. Calcium carbonate you can think of as chalk. You know, the chalk cliffs of Dover are just sedimentary fossils of small little marine organisms that make their houses out of calcium carbonate.
Carbonic acid, it calls to mind my mother's warnings about Coca-Cola. You know, you could dissolve a rat's tooth in it. Don't drink it, that kind of thing. But get to this point about changing acidity and the chemistry of the water. People know this, I think, mainly by analogy with their gardens. Adding lime to grow tomatoes. Right. Measuring your pH, and it's crucial in terms of, you know, what your garden grows. What does it mean in the water that the pH factor is changing?
The thing we think we know well, even perhaps better than what might happen in the future with temperature or sea level rise, is that as the oceans take up this carbon dioxide, we're going to lower the pH. We're going to make it more acidic. What happens, and what's been very interesting over the last few years, is people have started to take a whole variety of different plants and animals that live in the ocean. So corals, different types of plankton, mollusks, and they've exposed them to these more acidic conditions. And almost across the board in these experiments, we've seen that the organisms don't do nearly as well. They can't form their shells. Some of them can't grow well. They can't reproduce as well. And that, the one of the open questions is, if this whole class of organisms starts to fail, what are going to be the ecological implications further up the food chain? You know, is it going to affect marine mammals? Is it going to affect fish and fisheries? Is it just going to degrade the ecosystems in the ocean, similar to what activities have done on land?
In your garden, on your lawn, you'd add lime. What do you do with an ocean that's going sour?
Well, probably the thing to do is not to try to fix the problem in the ocean. As far as we can tell, the real only way of solving this problem is to emit less fossil fuel to the atmosphere. And so that gets into questions about how much energy do we use, where does our energy come from, Do we try to capture the carbon before it's emitted from the atmosphere? This has been a suggestion of capturing carbon and actually putting it back into oil wells and gas wells before it gets released into the atmosphere.
But Scardone, it also makes me wonder how much of the the acidification problem is reversible, is treatable, curable at all.
This is one of the real tricky aspects of climate change, which is we're already committed to a certain amount of climate change no matter what we do. We've emitted a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere already. Most of that on 1,000-year timescales is going to end up in the ocean. It would be very hard to stop that. Similarly with warming, even if we were to stop, you know, cut off all carbon dioxide emissions to the atmosphere today, there would be some continued warming and also continued sea level rise into the future. Now, of course, we're not going to shut off carbon dioxide. There is no magical switch. There's no magical technological replacement that's going to do this overnight. And so we're really looking at many, many decades of environmental change into the future.
Scardone, in your own work, what's your method of measurement here of effects on species, on animals, on especially on plants? I was really thinking of the microscopic plankton. I mean, what do I do? Yeah, exactly. How do you get your evidence?
I got into this particular story originally because I was going to sea to make measurements of the carbon system because we were interested in, you know, how effective was the ocean as a sink for carbon. You know, we were thinking of it as, hey, this is great. The ocean's actually slowing global change. It's slowing global warming by taking up carbon dioxide. And about the time that we were doing a fair amount of work, I was out in the South Atlantic a couple of years ago doing a long series of field campaigns. Groups of biologists that we were collaborating with were starting to show these fairly significant negative impacts in culture. They were growing. One woman I work with a lot is Vicky Fabre, who's out in California. She was growing these small little mollusks called pteropods that are very important in the Southern Ocean.
Yeah, Elizabeth Colbert wrote about them.
Yeah, exactly. And so we started to combine, you know, field data we were collecting with her incubation results.
Hold it there. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we want to get to the simple questions of fish supply and also precedent. Has this ever happened before? We're talking about global warming as if it was just about the oceans. This is Open Source. We'll be back.
Hi, this is Brendan. I'm the open source blogger in chief. David, in preparation for our second annual Groundhog Day show, has posted a viewer's guide, an outline of the movie that reveals a hidden inner logic, a progression from, and I quote, self-centered smarm to transcendence. Read it on the site. Also, the Boston Globe has recalled its foreign correspondents. We're wondering about the demise of the Foreign Bureau, whether we'll get our international news in the same way in the future, and ultimately, whether we know what we should about the rest of the world. I am your man in Havana at radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with WGBH Radio in Boston. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about the global warming of the oceans as if that were the only problem. A system of biology, of chemistry, all unto itself. Scott Doney is a senior scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution on Cape Cod. You were speaking about the lessons of your own experiment, Scott, after you realized that the oceans weren't saving us from carbon, they were suffering from it too.
Right. So we, after doing some of this field work and looking at incubations, one of the things that I also do is I build a lot of numerical models to try to simulate the planet, to try to say, well, if we can understand what's going on now, can we make projections into the future that anybody from a policymaker to a business to a, you know, a municipal government might use to make decisions. And so we plugged all of the incubation data and our understanding of chemistry and our understanding of ocean circulation into some numerical simulations, ran them through a giant computer, and started to look at what the future might look like, say, 30 years from now or 50 years from now. And what we found, at least for the some of the coral species and some of the mollusk species, is that for large parts of the ocean, we could expect that those organisms would go extinct by the end of the century, particularly in the around Antarctica, which is quite sensitive to changes in seawater chemistry.
Which fish are we talking about?
These are mollusks that are forming the shells, but they're the base of the food web there. They're eaten, you know, they some of them live in the North Pacific. They're eaten by salmon. Some of them live in off of Antarctica, and they form part of the base of the food web that, you know, feed up to the large whales that feed there. An open question is what's going to happen to fish. That's, you know, we don't fully understand all of the impacts of ocean acidification, warming, changing ocean circulation. Mm-hmm. You know, ecology is a complex thing. I think the real concern is what we don't understand right now will bite us.
We'll come back to fish. We'll come back to all of it. But speak to the simple puzzle I asked you about before the break. Has this happened before? Have we had a crash of ocean species comparable to what E.O. Wilson worries about on land today?
Right. There have been a number of extinction events. In fact, you know, if you've ever taken a geology class, you know, you have this long list of different periods in geology. One of those ways those were originally defined was the fact that they were tracking fossils, and you'd get this big break where one set of fossils would go away, and then later on a new set of fossils would evolve. So there have been a couple of these large events where we think there was a big ocean acidification event. And one was about 55 million years ago, where we think there was a large release of perhaps methane into the atmosphere. It caused a lot of warming, but it also caused a lot of acidification in the ocean. And we can see that in the fossil record, that there was a large change in the marine fossils that we have records of, and also of marine chemistry.
So 55 million years was roughly the recovery period, or the rebuilding, regeneration?
Often these extinction events, the recovery period is on the order of 500,000 to, say, a million years. The event was about 55 million years ago, and then things took a while to come back to equilibrium. Unfortunately, I'm not planning to, you know, I don't think that's so long relative to the human time scale. Mm. And the rate that we're acidifying the ocean is very fast, comparable to most of these geological events.
Michael Barenfeld is our guest from the other end of the continent. He's a professor of botany and plant pathology at Oregon State University. And he's an authority, a student of ocean stratification. Michael Barenfeld, help Scott out here on the effects of global warming underwater.
Sure, Chris. The work that I do, believe it or not, is largely looking at biological processes in the ocean from space. Hmm. And it's very closely linked to the work that Dr. Doney has been doing. He mentioned the types of models, these climate models that he runs. And those models are used to try to take the knowledge we have about how the Earth's system works today and make predictions about how it would change under a varying climate, a warming climate perhaps. And from those models, we kind of get an understanding of the type of mechanisms that come into play. You know, not only does it predict, you know, how things might change in the future, but why? And what we're trying to do with our group is use satellite data to make observations on a global scale that allow us to test those kinds of processes. Scott talked about stratification. That's one of the things that we're concerned about. And the work that we do is on organisms called plankton. And plankton means free-floating or suspended in the water. And there are basically two big groups of plankton. One is the plants, which we call phytoplankton, And then there's the animals, which we call zooplankton, or zooplankton. And that's what zoo means, is animals. And a lot of people have heard about zooplankton because krill are zooplankton and whales eat krill. But the plankton that we work on are the phytoplankton, the plants. And I think a lot of times people are not really, when they look at the ocean, they don't think about plants. They think about water or something else. But there's a tremendous number of plants in the ocean, but they're microscopic. They're mostly all single cells, and you can't see them with your eyes. And so when I tell friends that I work on microscopic plants from space, they're a little surprised. I wonder if you can't see it with your eyes, how are you going to see it from a satellite?
Well, I was going to say, some of us read all of this in the New Yorker by Elizabeth Colbert, the idea of going to space to see something that you can't see with the naked eye. What is the pattern you see? The plankton you're worried about are the ones that photosynthesize from the top veneer of the ocean, but send the benefits throughout the whole system and feed. We take them as the beginning of the whole food chain. What's happening to these devils?
Yeah, that's right. Let me just answer the first part of that before we go on to what's happening. How do you see plants from space? And I think it's pretty easy for people to understand when I explain this, is that if you think about really, really, really clear water, it's really blue. And if you add more and more plants to that, it becomes greener, okay, because the plants have a pigment called chlorophyll. And so what we're doing from space is we're essentially measuring how green the water is, and we do it on a global basis and looking at how not only the total amount of greenness in the ocean changes, but how the distribution of the greenness changes.
Hmm.
Okay? And Dr. Doney talked about, ocean currents and how important they are. And if you look from space at the distribution of these little plants, it's not uniform. Some places have a lot of plants and some places have very little. And the total biomass of those plants, which is very interesting, is very small relative to the number or the biomass, the total amount of plant material on land. But the amount of photosynthesis that they do each year is about the same as the land plants.
Hmm. Really?
And we're talking about the whole Earth. We're looking at an annual photosynthetic rate of over 100 billion tons of carbon dioxide is taken up by these plants. It's a huge, huge number. And about 50% of that is in the oceans. Okay.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah. And so what we've been doing recently is looking at the whole record of good satellite measurements we now have from space and how these plants are changing with time. And the record started only about a decade ago with a little satellite called CWIFS. And when we look at this decade record, what we find is that on a global total, the amount of phytoplankton and their photosynthesis, which is what photosynthesis is, plants use sunlight to take carbon dioxide out of the air or out of the water and make it into new plant material.
Yes.
And that's called photosynthesis. And so we can derive or estimate photosynthetic rates from the satellite data. And what we find is that the global ocean photosynthesis during the first 2 years of the record increased fairly rapidly. And then ever since the end of that first 2 years, which is in 1999, it started to decrease. And it's been decreasing on average ever since.
And why? I suppose the first post is, why did it rise as late as the 90s?
Yeah, why did it rise? It's a really good question. It's actually very closely tied to climate. And you might remember in 1997, we had a really severe El Nino. I remember I was living on the East Coast, and you could see the effects on the changes in the weather, changes in the plants on the East Coast of the U.S. And that very strong El Nino has a huge signal in the oceans. What happens during those El Nino events is that the ocean circulation changes, and one of the real big parts of the change is that the upwelling in the center of the Pacific decreases. And the reason for that is that normally, under normal conditions, the trade winds blow across the Pacific, and that causes water on the north of the equator to move about 90 degrees to the right of the wind, and south of the equator about 90 degrees to the left of the wind. Okay.
But explain upwelling.
Well, that's what I'm getting at, is that if you push the water away to the north on the right and away to the south on the left, then you have to replace that water with water from deep in the ocean, and that's called upwelling. So the winds are blowing the water away from an area, and it's replaced by deep water, which is called upwelling. That's an upwelling process.
Okay.
It also happens on the coast. In Oregon here, we have summer winds that blow from the north to the south, and that moves water to the right of the wind, so offshore, and it's replaced with cold water from below, and it brings nutrients up with that cold water. So the first 2 years of the satellite record, the big increase that we saw was we went from a severe El Nino, where you have very little of this upwelling mm-hmm. in the equator, to a La Nina, which is very strong trade winds, strong upwelling along the equator. And so that's what was responsible for that first big increase in production. And ever since then, it's been going down. And so the question is why?
Let me just get it straight. It's the upwelling that churns up the nutrients to the plankton, really at the water's surface virtually, and it surged up with the El Nino, and it's lapsed since then. You're going to explain why.
Yeah, and I should explain also that, you know, well, why do plants care about upwelling? But plants in the ocean are just like plants on land. They need two things for sure. They need nutrients.
Right.
You know, we put nitrogen and phosphates on our field, and they need light. And in the oceans, the plants are kind of stuck between a hard spot and a rock. The light is at the surface, and the nutrients in the bottom are in the deep water. Okay, and
right.
So the upwelling brings that nutrient up to the plants so they can have nutrients in the sunlit part of the ocean. And that's why upwelling enhances the production of the ocean. Okay?
Yes.
And so what's happened since the 1999 La Nina, this cool event, is that, in general, the temperatures of the ocean have warmed. And the region that's been most affected are in the low latitudes and the mid-latitudes. So, you know, 45 degrees, 50 degrees latitude and towards the equator. And so we see that there's a general warming in these areas, on a global average for this area, a general warming from 1999 down to the present. And what happens is when you warm the water and you warm the climate, you know, the upwelling, of course, is going to be affected. But if you just generally warm the surface of the ocean, and Scott mentioned this too, is that when you warm it, the water not only expands, it becomes lighter, essentially. And so you get the lens of water at the surface of the plants in it that's considerably lighter than the cold, dense water beneath it, and it makes it harder and harder for the wind and ocean circulation to mix those nutrients up into the surface layer.
Scott Doney, I'm wondering, are you in on all of this measurement of effects of warming on the phytoplankton?
Yeah, one of the things we have to do in our numerical models is exactly what Mike's describing. We need to have basically like a little simulation of how phytoplankton grow and die and how the nutrients get up into the surface lit ocean. And so we've been doing a lot of work looking at both observations. You know, Mike has quite nicely talked about the satellites. There's also an extensive network of ships and sensors in the ocean that people have been trying to measure this temperature change and stratification. And then we've been trying to see if we can model that and get similar to results to what Mike's seeing from the satellites. Can our models match what we're measuring in the ocean and what we're seeing from space?
What are the best measures of the secondary effects, again, on the fish population or on animal life? Mike, that's really for you.
Okay. I don't know if Scott wanted to address that or not. Well, from the satellites, we can't actually see the fish with the types of measurements that we're doing. But we do know that there's a relationship between how much growth there is in plants and where those plants are at and the distribution and the growth rate of the fish. One of the things we have a very interesting record of is the changes in the number of anchovette and sardines that are caught caught in the Pacific Ocean, and we have a record of these catches over a long period of time, you know, like 100 years, and we find that the abundance of the anchovies and the sardines fluctuates on cycles of around 25 years, and that those are very closely related to warming and cooling events. The warming events are favorable for a sardine regime and the cooling more for an anchovy regime. So it's a clear historical record showing the very tight correspondence between climate, productivity, and fisheries. And we also have, of course, the very stark and more short-term observations that occurred during El Niños, where you see a very strong El Niño like the 1997 El Niño. And it's associated with, you know, massive changes in the distribution of fishes, as well as bird die-offs and marine mammal effects and things like that. So it's very clear from these types of fluctuations we have records of that there's a very important correspondence between, you know, where the phytoplankton are and how well they're growing, how happy they are, essentially, and what's going on with our fisheries.
You know, you're both reminding me with your scientific language of a not exactly scientific, wonderful book that a fellow named Steve Thomas wrote probably 10 years ago or more on The Last Navigator, but it was basically about Micronesian sailors of the utmost, almost mystical skill in reading currents and waves and wind and whitecaps and the kinds of upsurges and upwellings that you're talking about. Are there human measures, fisherman measures of or sailor measures of these effects that you're calibrating from outer space? That's for you, Scott.
Oh, I thought that was for
Either one, but I'm just thinking of human measures of these rather scary effects.
Yeah, one of the hard things, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of fisheries data. This has been something that people have been trying to keep track of for a long time. The problem, of course, is that, you know, we've been focusing so far on climate effects and things that affect the what you might think of the base of the food web and phytoplankton and basically the grass that grows at the bottom of the food web. But humans have also been changing the top of the food web rather dramatically. And so sometimes it's a little difficult to deconvolve all of the fisheries records because they're getting impacted both from changes in climate, but also from the fact that we've fished a lot of the major fisheries for a long period of time and had a dramatic impact. Perhaps Dr. Bernfeld has another.
Maybe after the break. We're talking about global warming as it impacts the oceans, which we once thought of as the barrier to certain environmental effects on land, but in fact, they're in on the change too, and they're suffering in many, many ways. This is Open Source. We'll be back after a very short break. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about global warming in the oceans. Nancy Knowlton joins us from Connecticut. She teaches marine biology at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in California. Nancy Knowlton, bring it down to the coral reefs and what we know or suspect or guess or fear is happening there.
Coral reefs around the world are suffering terribly. The reefs that I studied in the 1970s, which were covered with living coral, about 80% living coral, are now less than 5% living coral. And so the problems of climate change really are being added to a lot of other problems as well and pushing coral reefs really to a tipping point or a breaking point. The big problem for coral reefs with respect to climate change has to do with the fact that people ask, What are corals? Are they animal? Are they vegetable? Are they mineral? They're actually all three. They're animals, and they make a skeleton. But inside the tissues of the animals are single-celled plants, just like the plants that we've been talking about earlier in the show. And that's a very important but also delicate relationship between the coral animal and the plants and the single-celled plants and their tissues. The big problem is that these plants and their tissues can only tolerate temperatures about a degree centigrade or a couple degrees Fahrenheit higher than the average maximum that we currently experience today. And so when the water gets unusually warm, even to a relatively small extent, that relationship between the animals and the animal and plant that makes up a coral gets destabilized, and coral actually kicks the plants out of its tissue because the coral is reacting to the stress, and you get this phenomenon called coral bleaching, which I'm sure some of your listeners have read about.
Well, one of our correspondents, Hurley, who lives in Rome but grew up in the Caribbean, wrote on our page today. He said, "I swam and fished and explored the reefs as a child, and within the span of my own childhood, saw these same teeming technicolor formations turn into bone-white biological graveyards."
Exactly. When the corals first bleach, actually they're still alive, but the coral animal part is there. It's just they've just lost their partners, the plants. But eventually they depend on those plants for food, and the corals eventually starve to death. And so they turn bone white initially, and then ultimately the coral will die, and then the whole reef itself gets covered with seaweeds.
Well, there's the coral itself, but then there are the species that have to live there.
That's right.
What's happening to them?
Well, we don't know yet too much about what's happening to them because the diversity of reefs is so high, it's really hard to keep track of everything that lives with them. People estimate there are somewhere between 1 million and 10 million species that live on coral reefs.
Mm.
But those estimates are crazily vague. They're based on estimates of how many beetles there are in rainforest trees and a partial count of things that were living in a tropical aquarium in Baltimore. So we actually don't have a handle at all, even on the basic numbers of species that live on reefs. And so not surprisingly, we are even less sure about the extent to which they have to live on reefs. Probably some of the many organisms that live with corals can live also on reefs that have lost most of their living coral, but a lot of them probably can't. And so, but the exact balance between those that will be able to persist in the absence of corals and those that are going to go extinct is actually scientists really don't have a clue.
Scott Doney was talking about acidification. How does that chemical change affect coral reefs?
Well, it affects corals just the way it does all these other organisms that build skeletons. It makes it harder. Basically, it makes it harder for them to build skeletons, and so it'll slow down the rate at which corals can grow. If you think of a reef, you can think of a reef as a giant city, and parts of it are growing, and parts of that city are being demolished by sea urchins and fish that eat coral and turn it into sand. And so anything that either slows down the rate of growth or increases the rate of death is bad news for reefs. And when you get to the point where death is greater than growth, then of course you're going to lose reefs altogether. Mm-hmm. And so anything that slows down their growth, like acidification, is bad. And it's particularly bad because so many other things are happening to reefs as it is. For example, in 1998, during the last really strong El Nino, about 80% of the corals bleached and about 20% of them died. And that's bad enough. But when you talk to climate scientists and they tell you that conditions like 1998 are going to recur on an annual basis by 2020, then obviously 20% loss of corals on an annual basis is not compatible with having reefs, at least reefs as we know them.
Nancy, catch your breath. Our blogger-in-chief, Brendan Greeley, learns everything by reading the web very carefully. What do you find on ocean warming, Brendan?
Well, on our own blog, of the comments that people have been leaving, what they've been talking about the most is coral. We have another comment from Allison. She writes, "Last time I went diving off of Key West, the coral reefs there were deathly white as well." So, of all the effects that we're talking about so far this hour, coral is the one that seems to have at least grabbed somebody's imagination who's not a marine biologist. We've been talking a lot in the office about the need for charismatic macrofauna, things like pandas and polar bears that grab our imagination and make us aware of environmental issues. Is coral, our coral reef, something that we're all familiar with from home aquariums or vacations? Is that the charismatic macrofauna of this issue? Is that something that people can actually hang on to as a movement?
Well, I think corals, you could think of corals as the canaries in the environmental coral mine in terms of marine, the health of marine ecosystems. And it is something that people that have gone to warm waters on their vacations to snorkel in can relate to. And it's not just that they're bone white, but actually that there's no living coral at all. And anyone who's been to traveling to, say, Florida or Jamaica or anywhere in the Caribbean over the last 30 years has noticed a catastrophic change in these ecosystems.
Let's talk about the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. And I've never been there, but the National Geographic website on the Great Barrier Reef is fantastic. And people talk actually about the extinction of the coral there in a matter of half a century from now. I mean, this deserves a campaign.
Yes. Well, I think there are many reasons to be worried about climate change, and coral reefs are certainly one of them. I guess it's also important, though, to you can kind of overdo the doom and gloom end of things, and particularly in terms of campaigns, if people feel that there's nothing they can do, that all this, you know, we've already set the track towards warming and reefs are doomed, that's actually not very helpful. And in fact, it's not scientifically accurate either. It turns out that these little plant cells in corals, we used to think it was just one kind in all different corals and giant clams and a variety of other things that have these relationships. And it turns out they're hugely diverse genetically. And some of those plants that the corals live with, the single-celled algae, they actually are very resistant to high temperatures. And so we do have a little bit of breathing room. And I think it's important to recognize that it's not totally doom and gloom. That's not to say that we don't have to really start doing something about climate yesterday. But reefs are not necessarily doomed as we speak today, and I think that's important to recognize as well.
So what fish will we be eating in 10 years, Nancy?
I'm sorry, I couldn't quite hear.
What fish will we still be eating 10 years from now?
What fish will we be eating? Well, we'll probably be eating less top predators and more fish lower down in the food web, because we've already, according to fisheries biologists, we've actually already eaten up about 90% of the big fish in the ocean. So we're going to eat smaller and smaller fish. In fact, if you some students at Scripps pulled together a bunch of menus over the last 100 years, and you can actually already see the change in our fish diet. That's not necessarily caused by global warming. In fact, it's mostly caused by overfishing. But we're already having such big effects that you could actually see it in menus.
We'll be eating jellyfish one day.
People do eat jellyfish in some parts of the world with enthusiasm, but it is true that jellyfish are down towards the bottom of the food chain, and some people have argued that we'll be down to slime and jellyfish in terms of what's going to be in the ocean.
Eat your dinner before your dinner eats you, in other words.
Yeah.
I want to ask all of you, I mean, people on dry land notice the effects of this remarkably warm winter, certainly up until the last week or so in the East Coast, so warm that people have seen, you know, crocuses and flowering plants in January, and it makes everybody talk about it. What are the kinds of changes that people, that ocean people, not just scientists, but fishermen, divers, beachcombers, can notice on their own with the naked eye about the ocean? Scott Doney?
Well, I'm trying to. That's actually a question I haven't heard before. I mean, the way I usually
love
think
those
about,
questions.
Yeah, thanks.
Sorry.
I mean, I certainly notice it because I live in a part of the world that often gets sea ice during the winter, and we've had we have not had any sea ice this winter. And I think that's, for me, one of the biggest changes to note, because it's so blatantly obvious during the winter. What worries me is during the summer, just changes in the kind of fish species you see, changes in jellyfish populations. As the warmer water, we're going to get warmer and warmer water coming up the East Coast, you're going to start to see whole different types of populations than what you've been used to if you grew up around here when you go down to the beach.
Michael Barenfeld, what can you see among the seals off the Oregon coast?
Don't know if I've seen any changes in the seals, except they're eating a lot of the salmon. But One of the things that people do have noticed the last couple of years here has been it's gotten a lot of press, of course, is the occurrence of very large anoxic zones off the coast of Oregon. And, you know, we can't tie that directly to climate change, but it is related to the wind patterns that are taking place in the summertime. And I talked earlier about, you know, how the wind blowing from the north to the south along the west coast of the U.S. drives upwelling. And changes in the intensity and the duration of those winds changes the amount of production that's going on off the coast here, and that's related to the anoxic zones.
What is an anoxic zone?
Anoxic zone, they're off the coast of Oregon, for example, the deep part of the water column here on the shelf becomes depleted of oxygen. There's essentially no oxygen down there, and that kills animals, crabs and things like that.
Of course.
And so that's been a big problem the last 2 years, and it's been clearly linked to changes in the wind patterns that we've had those 2 years, changes in the upwelling intensity and the duration of those upwelling winds. And so it's not necessarily, you know, directly tied to long-term climate change, but it certainly makes people aware of this link between, you know, the winds and the weather and ocean biology.
It must be the climate, but our blogger-in-chief Brendan Greeley is back for more.
Looking over the blog tonight, we found a healthy debate about global warming, but for a few mentions of coral, it was all about the above sea level effects of it, including an entertaining excursion into the reforestation of the Scottish Highlands. Very highly charged topic on the site. We as humans obviously tend to focus on what we can see, and what we can see is above sea level. So it's a question for Scott Doney. Do you find this sort of understandably human focus a hindrance when trying to get people to understand the possible consequences of warming of the oceans?
Well, yeah, I have to admit I've heard several times over the years, well, so who cares if the oceans, you know, if plant life in the oceans go extinct or changes in ocean circulation? And there's a variety of reasons to care beyond just the simple, these are ecosystems that are there, they've existed there for, in some cases, millions of years, and we're having an impact. You know, there's sort of that sort of ethical level of concern. But as Mike has pointed out, and as Nancy has pointed out, we interact with the oceans a tremendous amount. A large fraction of the world population lives near the coast. We depend upon the ocean for fisheries, for transportation, for recreation. And it's going to be a very different world 30 years, 50 years, 100 years from now than what we're used to. I think one of the most stunning results that's come out in the last couple of years is that it looks like the Arctic during the summer is going to be ice-free by the middle of this century. And you know, imagine that. That's a dramatic change in the basic picture of what the Earth would look like from space with no sea ice over the Arctic.
So the Northwest Passage is coming.
Yeah. Yeah, we will finally have that Northwest Passage that
we looked for so long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nancy, go ahead. Nancy, you're the cheerful scientist among us. I wondered.
I'm actually called Dr. My husband and I are often called Dr. Doom and Gloom, so I don't know how cheerful I am.
But remind us why you're not terminally gloomy, and also comment on the point we talked about earlier about how much of this is reversible.
Well, I guess the reason I'm not terminally gloomy is there's not much point in being terminally gloomy. If you're terminally gloomy, things will just continue to get worse, and I think it requires a certain amount of at least cautious optimism that people are able to recognize change. I think, in fact, there's been a huge change in people's awareness of climate issues. When you compare, I mean, here you are doing a show, Al Gore's movie, there's the Senate hearings, there's a lot happening, and people really are waking up to the issues of climate change. I actually think Hurricane Katrina had a big impact as well because of the link between the strength of hurricanes and global warming and starting to affect insurance rates on people can no longer afford to buy houses on the coast. So there are a lot of things that are actually having an impact on people. Just at my mom's house here, she lives right on a salt marsh, And our most of our lawn, which used to be a perfectly nice lawn when I was growing up, is now dead from salt water. And so you're already starting to see the effects of these big storms and also sea level rise. And you're seeing actually the sea creep onto to the coastline measurably in the course of my lifetime. That's actually a really something we haven't talked about. But in terms of salt marshes, which are environments that everyone certainly in the northern United States is familiar with, those are very seriously impacted by climate change and sea level rise, not because they aren't in principle capable of creeping up higher and higher, but because in essentially every case they're ringed by people's houses. The salt marsh that my parents live next to has people's houses and lawns all around it. So as sea level rises, that salt marsh is essentially going to run up against human habitation.
People care, and you can read it on our blog, Nancy Knowlton. John Allen just wrote on our site, life on Earth depends upon the health of its oceans. If we don't understand that global warming has everything to do with the oceans and that it will extinguish life on Earth, we'll inevitably get there a whole lot sooner.
Yeah.
Thank you all. Nancy Knowlton, Scott Downey, Michael Berenfeld. You can keep talking about global warming and the oceans. You can help us work on the next shows at RadioOpenSource.org. Open Source is produced in association with WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, training practitioners and students for leadership in human rights. RadioOpenSource.org, the website, is hosted by Contegix, Contegix.com. Our show is produced by David Miller, Brendan Greeley, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Murs, Robin Amer, and Greta Pemberton, with help from Julia Reichel and Sam Gale Rosen. Mike Wilkins was our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
PRI, Public Radio International.